radio stations, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, whose salons can be viewed at maternalgifteconomymovement.org. I'm Wing Series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
I don't care if it takes every second of our time and every ounce of our energy. We either get this government back on our side or we defund and get rid of, abolish the FBI, CDC, ATF, DOJ, every last one of them, if they do not come to heel.
Donald Trump has picked far-right Congressman Matt Gaetz to be his attorney general, who would head the Department of Justice, which Gaetz once wanted abolished. The nomination shocked many in Washington, in part because Gaetz himself was the target of a DOJ sex trafficking investigation and was still under a House ethics probe that ended only yesterday when Gaetz resigned from Congress before a highly damaging report comes out. We'll look at his nomination and the growing fear Trump will weaponize the department to go after political enemies. Then to Gaza, as a special UN committee says Israel's actions are, quote, consistent with the characteristics of genocide. And a federal judge in Virginia has ordered the U.S. military contractor CACI to pay $42 million to three Iraqi men who were tortured at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. A UN special committee has found Israel's actions in Gaza since October 2023 are consistent with genocide, including using starvation as a weapon of war and recklessly inflicting civilian casualties. The report released today comes one day after a Human Rights Watch report found Israel's committed war crimes and crimes against humanity through its mass forced displacement of civilians in Gaza. Human Rights Watch is calling on nations to adopt sanctions and halt weapon sales to Israel. But Israel's indiscriminate slaughter continues, with at least five Palestinians killed today in central Gaza's Amagazi refugee camp. Elsewhere, at least two people were killed by an Israeli strike on a tent encampment for displaced Palestinians near Nuseirat. Meanwhile, the UN's Humanitarian Affairs Office warned Palestinian children are at high risk of injury or death from unexploded ordnance left after more than 13 months of Israeli attacks. Among the victims is severely wounded 8-year-old Mohammed Karmash. This is his mother.
No one was there to tell him that these are explosives that the Israelis throw. The children play with them and they blow up. What is happening to us is not fair. His father died at the Karni border and his body stayed there. What is happening to us is not fair, really.
In Lebanon, Israel launched at least seven airstrikes on Beirut's southern suburbs overnight after ordering residents to leave their homes. At least eight people were killed in Israeli attacks on the village of Dahit Aramun, south of the capital. Israeli warplanes also struck Damascus and the Syrian city of Homs. In southern Lebanon, Israel's army says six soldiers were killed Wednesday in exchange of gunfire with Hezbollah fighters defending Lebanese territory. The deaths were announced after Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said he'd expanded Israel's military ground operation in southern Lebanon. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting a close aide to Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Donald Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, this week that Israel's rushing to advance a ceasefire deal in Lebanon is a gift to Trump ahead of his inauguration in January. The UN Security Council voted to extend sanctions on Yemen for another year, freezing assets and banning travel by leaders of Yemen's Houthi movement. Wednesday's vote came after the U.S. and U.K. launched airstrikes on Yemen over the weekend, targeting what the Pentagon said were advanced weapon storage facilities. The bombings came after Houthis fired missiles and drones at Israel and attacked commercial vessels in the Red Sea in response to Israel's war on Gaza and Lebanon. Senate Republicans have selected John Thune of South Dakota to become the next majority leader, replacing Mitch McConnell as the party's leader. Republicans picked the establishment conservative over Texas Senator John Cornyn and Trump loyalist Florida Senator Rick Scott. The White House is urging Senate Democrats to quickly confirm some 30 federal judges appointed by President Biden before Trump comes into office and Democrats lose control of the Senate. Meanwhile, Pennsylvania Senate race is headed for a recount as Republican David McCormick remains ahead of incumbent Democratic Senator Bob Casey by only 28,000 votes. If McCormick's lead holds, Republicans will have a 53-seat majority in the U.S. Senate. Meanwhile, House Republicans have nominated Speaker Mike Johnson to remain head of the conference as Republicans cemented their control of the House of Representatives. In other news from Washington, President Biden hosted Trump at the White House Wednesday, continuing a longstanding tradition, though Trump did not host Biden after Trump's loss in the 2020 election. President-elect Trump announced Wednesday he's nominating disgraced Florida Congressman Matt Gaetz as Attorney General. Also on Wednesday, Gaetz abruptly resigned from Congress. It came just 2 days before a highly damaging report about Gaetz was set to be released by the House Ethics Committee, according to multiple sources. Gaetz was at the center of a sex trafficking probe, which included allegations he misused campaign funds, engaged in bribery, and obstructed government. The House committee has now lost its jurisdiction to investigate Gaetz since he retired, though it could still release their report. Trump's also nominated former Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard to become Director of National Intelligence. Before entering politics, Gabbard was part of the U.S. Army's Psychological Operations Command. Critics warn of Gabbard's support for anti-Muslim figures, including Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi and his Hindu nationalist government. Meanwhile, concerns are mounting over Trump's pick to lead the Pentagon. The Fox News weekend host and military veteran Pete Hegseth. CBS News reports Hegseth was one of 12 National Guard members who was removed as a guard for President Biden's 2021 inauguration over possible extremist ties. Hegseth has tattoos associated with the white supremacist and neo-Nazi movements, including what's known as the Jerusalem Cross, a symbol used by Christian nationalists. In related news, the government watchdog Accountable U.S. announced it's launching a Trump accountability war room to monitor Trump's appointments and executive actions as he takes up his second term. House Democrats are introducing a resolution to clarify the Constitution's two-term limit for presidents applies even if the terms are not consecutive. The resolution, set to be unveiled by New York Congressmember Daniel Goldman today, comes after Trump joked to House Republicans on Wednesday, quote, "I suspect I won't be running again unless you say he's so good we've got to figure something else out," unquote. A new study suggests the death toll in Sudan's devastating civil war is far higher than is being reported, with as many as 61,000 killed in Khartoum in the first 14 months of the war, which began in April of last year. Researchers from the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine say over a third of those were violent deaths, while others were caused by starvation, illness, and lack of medical care. Most deaths were not officially recorded, as many victims were never brought to a morgue or treated in a hospital, many of which have been destroyed in the fighting. This is Mohammed Omar, who helped bury his friend, the musician Khalid Sankhouri, in his front yard in the city of Omdurman.
My brother Khaled was sick and the war started, and this is a frontline area. There were no hospitals or pharmacies where we could get medicine, not even markets to buy food, which is essential to one's health. These were all factors which had an impact until his body was frail and he got sick.
The war in Sudan has forced some 11 million people to flee their homes and led to the world's largest hunger crisis. Half of Sudan's population, nearly 25 million people, are in need of aid. Earlier this week, the Darfur Women Action Group appealed to the UN Security Council to deploy peacekeepers to Sudan, citing the scorched earth tactics of the paramilitary rapid support forces in North Darfur, including rampant sexual violence and indiscriminate killings. In Haiti, Two patients being treated by Doctors Without Borders were killed after their ambulance was ambushed in the capital, Port-au-Prince. The organization said its workers were violently attacked by vigilantes and police officers during the ambush. The attack comes as Haiti is suffering a worsening security and humanitarian crisis. Earlier this week, the Federal Aviation Administration banned all civilian flights from the U.S. to Haiti for a month after gang members fired on JetBlue and Spirit Airlines planes at the Port-au-Prince airport. As the COP29 climate summit continues in Azerbaijan, activists stage a protest at a Baku sports stadium, holding up giant letters spelling out the words, "Pay up." Financing is the key issue of this year's summit, but wealthy nations like the U.S. have so far refused to commit the necessary funds to manage the climate crisis they've disproportionately created. This is Sandra Guzman from the group GFLAC.
For instance, if we reduce the fossil fuel subsidies, if we tax the richest, we could be already generating sources to pay for climate change. So it's not a lack of money. It's a lack of a political will to allocate that money where it is needed.
This comes as a new report says $1 trillion per year should be spent on helping poorer countries mitigate the effects of the climate disaster. A separate report finds the world is on track for a disastrous 2.7 degree centigrade temperature rise. In other news from COP29, Argentina has withdrawn its 80-plus negotiators from the UN summit. Argentina's far-right president, Javier Milei, has previously called the climate crisis a socialist lie. A Central Intelligence Agency official is due to appear in federal court on Guam today, charged with disclosing classified documents that revealed Israeli military planning to attack Iran. The documents reference recent Israeli drills involving air-launched ballistic missiles, as well as covert drone activity. The official, Asif Rahman, was arrested in Cambodia last week and indicted on two counts of willful retention and transmission of national defense information under the Espionage Act. Meanwhile, a federal court in Massachusetts has sentenced Air National Guardsman Jack Teixeira to 15 years in prison for violating the Espionage Act. The 22-year-old had pleaded guilty to leaking highly classified Pentagon intelligence documents about Russia's war in Ukraine to a group of gamers on the messaging app Discord. Teixeira was convicted of violating the same part of the Espionage Act initially used by federal prosecutors to charge Donald Trump over his mishandling of classified documents at Mar-a-Lago before U.S. District Judge Aileen Cannon, a Trump appointee, dismissed the case. We'll have more on this story later in the broadcast. And in media news, The Guardian announced it'll no longer post their content on X, formerly known as Twitter, though X users will still be able to share Guardian articles from the platform. The Guardian writes, quote, "The U.S. presidential election campaign served only to underline what we've considered for a long time, that X is a toxic media platform and that its owner, Elon Musk, has been able to use its influence to shape political discourse." And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Coming up, Donald Trump's picked far-right Congressman Matt Gaetz to be Attorney General. He'll head the Justice Department, a move that shocked many in Washington. Coming up in a minute. Dorian by Roy Haynes, the legendary jazz drummer, died Tuesday at the age of 99. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, War, Peace, and the Presidency. I'm Amy Goodman. Many lawmakers on Capitol Hill are expressing shock. President-elect Donald Trump's selection of Florida Congressmember Matt Gaetz to be Attorney General. Gaetz is a far-right Trump loyalist who led the effort to oust House Speaker Kevin McCarthy last year and has defended participants in the January 6th insurrection. The nomination of Florida Congressman Gaetz is widely seen as part of Trump's plans to weaponize the Department of Justice to target political enemies. But his confirmation in the Senate is not guaranteed. Gaetz was recently under a federal sex trafficking investigation involving an underage girl. While federal charges were never filed, the House Ethics Committee has also been looking into Gaetz' actions. The committee was scheduled to release what was expected to be a highly damaging report about Gaetz as soon as Friday. But on Wednesday, following his nomination, Gaetz resigned as congressmember from the House, likely putting an end to the probe. The House Ethics Committee had previously said it was investigating whether Gaetz, quote, may have engaged in sexual misconduct and or illicit drug use, shared inappropriate images or videos on the House floor, misused state identification records, converted campaign funds to personal use, and or accepted a bribe, improper gratuity, or impermissible gift in violation of House rules, laws, or other standards of conduct, unquote. 4 years ago, Gaetz sought a preemptive pardon from Trump. This is Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen of Oklahoma speaking to CNN last year, shortly after Gaetz helped oust House Speaker Kevin McCarthy.
You got to think about this guy. This is a guy that didn't have, that the media didn't give a time of day to after he was accused of sleeping with an underage girl. And there's a reason why no one and the conference came and defended him, because we had all seen the videos he was showing on the House floor that all of us had walked away of the girls that he had slept with. He'd brag about how he would crush ED medicine and chase it with an energy drink so he could go all night. This is obviously before he got married. And so when that accusation came out, no one defended him, and then no one on the media would give him a time of the day. All of a sudden, he found fame because he opposed the Speaker of the House.
That was Republican Senator Mark Wayne Mullen speaking about Congressman Matt Gaetz last year. We're joined now by two guests. Zach Beauchamp is a senior correspondent at Vox covering the crisis of global democracy, the author of The Reactionary Spirit: How America's Most Insidious Political Traditions Swept the World. Noah Bookbinder is the president of the D.C. watchdog nonprofit Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, known as CREW. He formerly prosecuted public corruption cases for the Department of Justice. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Noah Bookbinder, let's begin with you. First, talk about how important the attorney general is, and especially for our global audience, to explain what it means to run the Department of Justice, and then to talk about who Matt Gaetz is.
Sure. So the attorney general is the chief law enforcement officer of the United States. The attorney general runs the Department of Justice, which brings all federal prosecutions in the United States, but also handles vast amounts of civil litigation, environmental litigation, civil rights litigation. The Department of Justice sets legal policy for the executive branch of the government. It's hard to overstate what an important position the attorney general is, both in the actual management of the justice system in the United States, and it's setting the tone for how justice works in the United States. Now, I don't think anybody should be shocked when Donald Trump does exactly the kind of thing that Donald Trump said he would do and the kinds of things that he's done in the past. So in some ways, this is not a shocking nomination. Matt Gaetz is a loyalist to Donald Trump. He is a firebrand in the spirit of Donald Trump, but he is somebody who has no appreciable law enforcement experience. He has downplayed the January 6th attacks on the Capitol and actually promoted conspiracy theories about them. And he's been the subject of legal and ethical investigations himself. So he is certainly not the kind of person you want setting the tone for the justice system in the United States, not the kind of person you want making decisions about how the Department of Justice is going to work.
Now, Noah, if you can explain the sex trafficking allegations that Matt Gaetz has been dealing with for years. You have this reportedly very damaging report, though no criminal charges were brought, that the Department of Justice was going to release. And by him resigning yesterday, the report apparently doesn't come out unless it's leaked.
Well, so on that last point first, it is true that the House Ethics Committee generally investigates members of the House of Representatives while they are there, and often or generally investigations close when members leave. But there actually is precedent for that committee to investigate members after they have left and release reports after they have left. So that is something that that committee can do, should do, as this nomination is considered. And, you know, there's no reason why that investigation and that report has to die because Congressman Gaetz just resigned. He was investigated for apparently for sexual conduct with an underage person, for potential involvement in trafficking, for potential drug use, for potential sharing of inappropriate videos on the House floor. We don't know the facts because as of now, there haven't been charges and we haven't seen that House Ethics Committee report. But our organization has actually sued to obtain the Department of Justice's files on their investigation. And there is that House report that reportedly is very damaging and that ought to be made public, and it should be made public right away.
I want to go to House Speaker, former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, speaking at Georgetown in April about then Congressman Matt Gaetz.
And I'll give you the truth why I'm not Speaker. It's because one person, a member of Congress, wanted me to stop an ethics complaint because he slept with a 17-year-old. An ethics complaint that started before I ever became Speaker, and that's illegal, and I'm not going to get in the middle.
So that is former House Speaker Kevin McCarthy. I want to bring Zach Beauchamp into the conversation, senior correspondent for Vox. If you can tell us more about Matt Gaetz, also his past connection with Joel Greenberg, and his resume, however thin it is.
Yeah, I mean, Finn is right. He is a law school graduate, so technically he's a lawyer, but there is no law enforcement experience to speak of, as we just learned. He's been a member of Congress. He's 42 years old, if I'm recalling the exact number correctly. And look, I'm in my late 30s, nothing against younger adults being ambitious, but you really need to be extraordinarily impressive if you want to, at the particular stage in his career, take a job as big as attorney general, and Gaetz just doesn't have any relevant qualifications to do that. Moreover, his chief qualification, right, as far as I can tell, based on all the reporting that's come out, is his willingness to do whatever Donald Trump needs to be done, right? Trump picked him because, according to a report in the Bulwark this year, sourced to Trump insiders, or excuse me, this morning, he was going in there and he wants to start chopping heads, though there's an expletive in there that I've cut out for broadcast purposes. He really, really is the kind of person that you would appoint if what you're trying to do is to take an axe to the nonpartisan functioning of the Justice Department.
So I want to go to Matt Gaetz in his own words, speaking at CPAC, that's the Conservative Political Action Conference, in 2023.
I don't care if it takes every second of our time and every ounce of our energy. We either get this government back on our side or we defund and get rid of, abolish the FBI, CDC, ATF, DOJ, every last one of them, if they do not come to heel.
So, Noah Bookbinder, if you can comment on this and also talk about what it would mean if he was attorney general, what it would mean also in terms of the cases against Donald Trump, the president-elect?
Yeah, well, one of the key things about the Department of Justice and the Attorney General is that they need to have some independence from the administration. There have been protections built in over decades that, you know, you don't have a president dictating who's going to be prosecuted, who's not going to be prosecuted. You know, certainly the president's policy preferences play a role, but the president should not be deciding what kind of justice is administered. What you heard from Matt Gaetz is the polar opposite of that. You heard Congressman Gaetz essentially saying that the Department of Justice and these other parts of government have to be brought to our side. They have to be brought to heel. They should essentially be made political weapons of a particular party and a particular president. That is not how the Department of Justice has ever functioned and not how it's meant to function in our system. So I think there is a real danger that if you put in somebody like Matt Gaetz and he does the kinds of things that he says he's going to do and that Donald Trump seems to want an attorney general to do, you're going to have a entirely different, much less democratic system in the United States, where you have a Department of Justice and a justice system that is meant to serve the political objectives of the person in power rather than actually serving justice. And that's something that, regardless of the decision that Americans made in the election recently, I don't think there are very many Americans who want that.
Zach Beauchamp, you tweeted yesterday, Gaetz at justice is the clearest signal of authoritarian intent imaginable. And you also tweeted, inside Trump's ominous plan to turn civil rights law. Well, this was a headline of a piece that you wrote, inside Trump's ominous plan to turn civil rights law against vulnerable Americans. Talk about both. You'd also written about making America hungry again.
That's right. So my book is about how modern authoritarianism works and why it rises in countries that seemed like previously strong or healthy democracies. And one of the clearest pathways, right, from getting from a democracy to a more authoritarian system of government is the replacement of key government functionaries and executive figures with loyalists. So when you take people who had a degree of independence, as the attorney general is supposed to, and you turn them into political apparatchiks who twist the law into whatever the chief executive of the country needs it to be in order to advance his political interests, that to me is that's sort of like the biggest, clearest, we are in trouble signal that one could send. And given especially that CPAC clip that you just played and Gaetz's long track record of talking like this, he's exactly that kind of person. Now, the civil rights question you asked, right? So what I was trying to do when I wrote that piece is to take what Trump and his staff have talked about sort of abstractly and see how it would play out when it applies to one portion of the Justice Department, specifically the Civil Rights Division, which has a very, very large ambit of responsibilities. But, you know, in brief, you can summarize it as enforcing the laws that are designed to address structural inequalities in the American political system. And so that means that they enforce anti-discrimination law in employment, in housing. It means that they deal with the Voting Rights Act and enforcement of discrimination in voting law, on down the list, right? And so what you can see if this department is twisted to do what Trump wants it to do is a department that functions in the exact inverse of the way it's supposed to. So to take anti-discrimination law, what you can do is turn it into anti-discrimination against whites, which is to say dismantling protections for minority groups and using those laws that are designed to create essentially an environment of, hi, sweetie, hold on, I'm on TV, to create an environment in which people are prosecuted for creating systems that are designed to ameliorate longstanding patterns of discrimination by calling it a new form of anti-white discrimination.
I know that you have to go, Zach, to do some childcare duties, and so I'm going to let you go. She is very, very sweet. Zach Beauchamp is senior correspondent at Vox, covering the crisis of global democracy, and we'll have you back on all too soon. Author of the recent book, The Reactionary Spirit, How America's Most Insidious Political Tradition Swept the World. But Noah Bookbinder, given that you don't have kids who are pulling at your sleeve, I want to ask you about the court cases that Donald Trump faces or now will not face. You know, a lot of people say the cases are just going to go away. But I think it's important before they do, if they do, to remember what they are, what he is dealing with, what will happen to the evidence. Jack Smith is apparently wrapping up. And for that, again, a global audience, who is Jack Smith? What are these two federal cases that he's dealing with? Then we'll talk about the state cases.
So Jack Smith is a longtime federal prosecutor who was appointed as special counsel to handle two investigations of Donald Trump. One of them was into misuse and mishandling of classified information, sort of very serious abuses of information that is crucial to America's national security that Trump appears to have kind of left around at Mar-a-Lago, where it was incredibly vulnerable, and to have hidden from the federal government. And the other investigation is an investigation into Donald Trump's role in efforts to keep him in power after losing the 2020 election and to overturn the results of that election, including inciting a violent insurrection. So these are about as serious a set of offenses for a democracy, as you can imagine. Trying to keep yourself in power after you lose an election really cuts at the heart of a democracy. These are not trivial investigations. They are not politically motivated investigations. They're deeply important investigations to America. What appears to be happening is that Jack Smith recognizes that the Department of Justice has a policy that says that a sitting president, that the Department of Justice will not prosecute a sitting president. I think we've always questioned whether that is a legally correct interpretation. Certainly even less clear that it applies to an investigation, to investigations like these ones that began before Donald Trump's coming term for president. But that is the Department of Justice's policy. I think Jack Smith looks at that and says, these are going to be impossible to bring anyway. And he looks at that further and says that if he stays, he and his team are likely to be fired, could go beyond that. They could be investigated, which could cause a crisis. And if he dismisses those cases, closes down the investigation, as he may be seeing it, that could get you to the same place without the crisis, and is potentially a way to protect his team. But it does mean that these deeply, deeply serious investigations could have the plug pulled on them, which is deeply troubling for democracy. I will say that Jack Smith can, I believe should, and I believe will, release a report before he goes, setting out the findings of these investigations and getting that information to the people of the United States.
It will be public?
He doesn't have to do that. He may not do that, but I think that he will. It's certainly what Special Counsel Mueller did in the case that he investigated. It's pretty standard practice, and I have to imagine that Jack Smith's team is hard at work on a public report now that they understand that these cases are very unlikely to make it to trial.
So we haven't even talked about the Mar-a-Lago documents yet, or I should say the White House or the government documents that he brought to Mar-a-Lago. But what about the insurrectionists, the hundreds and hundreds of people who are jailed right now, and what you think Donald Trump will do, who bills himself as the law and order president, but more than 100 police officers were injured? A number died. Some took their own lives. One had an attack the day after he dealt with the gas.
This is You know, these are not people who are being prosecuted for protesting. They're not the subject of political prosecutions. These are people who are being prosecuted for, in most cases, violent offenses, including assaulting police officers. It's exactly the kind of conduct that law and order politicians tend to abhor, right? Attacking police officers. And yet, Donald Trump has said that he intends to pardon at least some of these people. You know, I think that would be would send a deeply destructive message to the democracy that you can try to overturn an election, try to install someone in power who wasn't elected, and that would be okay, and you can come out just fine. I think that would be a very dangerous message to send. I think, you know, as I was saying before with the Matt Gaetz nomination, I think we can't be shocked if Donald Trump does the things that he has said he was going to do. I think people tend to discount a lot of what he says. I certainly expect that that there's a good possibility that he will do what he said he was going to do, that he will pardon some of these people, and you'll see essentially violent criminals who assaulted law enforcement being set free because they happen to agree with Donald Trump politically. And I think that if that is what occurs, that would be a dangerous day for our democracy.
Two last quick questions, and we have less than a minute. One is what happens with the document case. Aileen Cooper Cannon got rid of it. There's the talk of possibly he would nominate her to the Supreme Court, which goes to also the recess appointments. This whole issue of what that means, how you get people like Matt Gaetz through when perhaps the Senate wouldn't even approve him.
I think it's hard to see how that case comes back at this point where Jack Smith is talking about winding cases down. I think that's deeply unfortunate. It's a very clear case with real national security implications, but it's hard to see a path forward. Recess appointments. Look, we're in a situation where Donald Trump is looking to take unprecedented executive power. There are fewer and fewer checks on that power with a Congress that seems compliant and a Supreme Court that seems compliant. Senate confirmation of nominees is one of the few checks we have left. And if he seeks to subvert that by making large-scale recess appointments, that's one fewer check on his power.
And how does he get the power to do that? What does that mean? He just says Matt Gaetz is the attorney general?
Well, there is a provision in law that says essentially when Congress goes into recess, there is an ability to name officials for a limited period of time, because historically you had situations where there was an emergency need for officials. Congress couldn't get to town as quickly. It is something that traditionally has not been used in large amounts. And, you know, this would be unprecedented. It is also for a limited period of time. And so it would then be up to the courts and to Congress to hold the administration to those limits and make sure that even if Donald Trump abuses this power, it's only temporary, and Senate confirmation is put into play as it legally needs to be.
Enough, let's say it was a year, time enough to destroy documents and also to investigate people that Donald Trump calls the enemy within.
That's right. It's a deeply, deeply dangerous and troubling concept. And I hope the Senate, you know, will make it clear that they're not going to tolerate that, you know, with Trump loyalists dominating his party. I'm not entirely confident that will happen, but I certainly hope so.
Noah Buchbinder, president of the D.C. watchdog nonprofit CREW, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington. He formerly was a Department of Justice lawyer. Coming up, we go to Gaza, as a special U.N. committee says Israel's actions are consistent with the characteristics of genocide. Back in 20 seconds. Ode to Billy Joy by Lou Donaldson. The famed saxophonist passed away November 9th at the age of 98. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn to Israel's war on Gaza. A special UN committee reported today Israel's action in Gaza are consistent with the characteristics of genocide, unquote. Another report by Human Rights Watch finds Israel's committed war crimes and crimes against humanity through its mass forced displacement of Gaza's civilians. This comes as the Biden administration's decided to continue arming Israel, even though aid groups say Israel's failed to meet a U.S.-imposed 30-day deadline to increase the flow of food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. We go now to Deir al-Balah in Gaza, where we're joined by Arwa Damon, founder of Anara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Previously spent 18 years at CNN, including time as a senior international correspondent. Thanks so much for being with us, Arwa. This is your fourth trip back to Gaza since October 7, 2023. Tell us what you see there.
You know, Amy, you think you can't get worse, and then it does. You think people, quite simply, could never cope with these deteriorating conditions, and yet somehow they do. It's a situation that they have been forced into. Arguably, the conditions when it comes to access of humanitarian organizations and our ability to distribute aid actually getting into the Strip, we're talking about the lowest levels yet. And this is exactly during the time frame that the U.S. had given to Israel to actually improve the situation. We've seen it getting significantly worse. We're not just talking about a shortage in things like flour, food, water, fresh vegetables, you know, hygiene kits. We're also talking about shortages in what's available on the commercial market. So even if you somehow had money to be able to go buy what you need, it quite simply isn't here. These hospitals that we keep talking about as being partially functioning, what does that actually mean? It means that if you show up bleeding, someone inside is going to try to stop the bleed, but do they actually have what they need to save your life? No. I was inside visiting some kids here at Aqsa earlier today and over the weekend. There's a little two-year-old boy here whose brain you can see pulsing through his skin. His skull bone was removed. This little boy was not stabilizing properly because the ICU was missing a pediatric-sized tracheostomy tube. Now, luckily, we were able to, you know, source some of them, and he has now stabilized, and he is off the ventilator. But this really gives you an idea of just how serious the situation here is. People are gathering to demonstrate for things like flour, for bread, for whatever it is that you can imagine. Winter is coming. The rains are coming. This means flooding is coming. And on top of just, you know, water flooding, we're also anticipating that the sewage sites are going to be flooding as well. Aid organizations need to be able to have the capacity and the ability to, you know, shift those sites to areas where they're not going to pose even more of a health hazard to the community. So, I mean, it's a complete and total nightmare. It's beyond being a nightmare.
If you can talk about this latest report, the special UN committee says Israel's action in Gaza are consistent with the characteristics of genocide, coming at the same time as a Human Rights Watch report. And UNRWA talks about famine being imminent in northern Gaza.
So if we're talking specifically about the north, the northern province of Gaza, this is an area where, you know, Israel launched its military operation there nearly 4 weeks ago. We have seen people repeatedly being forcibly displaced from their homes. There is very little access to medical assistance there. There has been absolutely no humanitarian assistance delivered there for about the last month. People are starving, they're dying, and it's not just bombs that are killing people, it's also disease. So when we look at the nature of what is happening in Gaza, you can't spend a day here, Amy, and not come away with the notion that you are witnessing a population that is being slowly exterminated. And I say slowly because, yes, bombs kill quickly, but disease and starvation, they are slow killers. And that is what a lot of people are facing here. And talk to anybody in Gaza, and there's absolutely no doubt in their mind that, one, they are living through their own annihilation, and, two, what Israel is doing in the northern part is going to be repeated elsewhere. And this is also part of why you see a reluctance among the population to want to evacuate, because Gazans know, Palestinians know, that when they leave, they're not going to be able to go back home. This is what history has taught them. And there is this very real ingrained fear among the population here right now that what they're going through at this moment is not the end. There is actually a real sense that the worst is yet to come. And they feel completely and totally abandoned by the international community, by global leaders, not to mention the United States. And everyone is convinced that right now Israel is going to have even more free rein to do whatever it is that it wants here. When you talk to people about what it is that they're going through, they do feel as if every single aspect of trying to survive here has been carefully orchestrated by Israel so that it is able to sort of meet America's bare minimum of standards, to allow America sufficient cover to say, oh no, there's improvement that's happening, and yet actually at the core of it is just another way to continue to kill the population.
And as you talk about the United States, which has given tens of billions of dollars in military aid to Israel, they did recently set a 30-day deadline to increase the flow of food and humanitarian aid into Gaza. But the U.S. has decided to keep arming Israel despite this, and despite the number of officials in the State Department and other parts of the U.S. government who have quit over this.
Yeah, and let's just look at the numbers. Let's just look at what happened when the U.S. started the clock for that 30-day deadline to improve humanitarian assistance. We saw very shortly afterwards the number of trucks accessing Gaza dip significantly, down to 30 a day, keeping in mind that one of the key demands that the U.S. had was that aid be increased to at least 350 trucks. So we saw this, you know, decrease consistent of roughly 30 trucks a day for most of the month of October. Now, in November, that number did go up to around 60, 70, but we're still talking about, you know, falling extraordinarily short, providing, you know, barely 20% of what it is that the population here needs. We saw less access to these besieged areas in the north where people are effectively trapped or having to basically risk their lives. We've had numerous instances where aid has been delivered to the Kamar Redwan Hospital in the north, for example, where shortly after medical evacuation teams have arrived there, there have been strikes. You have this very ingrained fear that exists among people right now, especially in the north, where some of them are saying, you know, don't deliver anything because right after you're delivering, strikes are happening. And just to illustrate how it is that we try to move, so if we're moving from, you know, south to north, for example, or even if we're moving within the northern areas, those movement requests have to be approved by Israel. And aid organizations are increasingly wary of moving around with what we call soft skin cars, which is basically your normal vehicle that we used to move around in, because of the increasing frequency of instances at Israeli checkpoints where aid convoys have been shot at by IDF troops after receiving the green light, the okay to cross through, which means that for a lot of aid organizations, movement is limited to those who have access to armored vehicles, vehicles that are more secure. And those don't really exist in Gaza in high numbers at all. And we're not allowed to bring in more to sort of beef up our capacity to be able to move around safely. I mean, no matter which way you look at it, Amy, you're constantly faced by numerous obstacles that don't need to be there. It feels very deliberate, not to mention the complete and total breakdown of security. Now we have numerous looting instances of aid trucks. We've repeatedly asked the Israeli side to be able to use alternative routes, to be able to use secured routes. Those requests are not being met. I mean, it's just, it's such an impossible situation to operate in. I feel like I keep saying the same thing over and over and over again. each time I come in. And the words to demonstrate how much worse it's getting quite simply lack in our vocabulary.
Mm. You also wrote a piece recently on the devastation of Lebanon for New Lines. And we had this headline, the Washington Post reporting close aide to Netanyahu told Donald Trump and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, that Israel's rushing to advance a ceasefire deal in Lebanon is a gift to Trump ahead of his January inauguration. Your response to the significance of Trump's election and what it means to the people of Lebanon and Gaza?
You know, first of all, anyone who lives in the Middle East and anyone who's kind of been focusing on the Middle East knows very well that it really doesn't matter who's in the White House, whether it's Republican or Democrat, that really is not going to change significantly U.S. policy towards this region. But the thing that we've been hearing, specifically when it comes to the re-election of Donald Trump, is at least he's not lying to us. At least whatever America is going to let Israel do, it's going to be done faster. So if our end is coming, at least it's going to come faster. Whereas when it comes to, you know, specifically the Biden administration, the sense is that the Democrats are far more willing to allow this slower, more painful death. But the end result, no matter who it is, people are fully convinced, is exactly the same. And all people really want right now is for this to end. People are suffocated. They're crushed. They cannot keep going like this. And they very much feel as if, you know, no matter what it is, no matter who it is, Arabs are viewed by the United States and by the Western world as somehow being less than. Their lives are not that valuable. You constantly hear people in Gaza, and we were hearing the same thing in Lebanon, making comments like, well, you know, America, it doesn't care if we live or die. It doesn't care how much we suffer. Our lives don't matter to them. And that is not really a perspective that changes all that much, no matter who is sitting in Washington.
We just have 30 seconds, Arwa. Why did you give up journalism for humanitarian work? What do you think you can accomplish at Inara that you couldn't do as a journalist?
There's a certain sort of privilege of being able to spend extensive periods of time with people and really get to know who they are. And I feel as if, you know, moving around in the humanitarian sphere, I'm getting a different understanding of sort of people's emotional journeys, what it actually takes to be able to provide them with assistance. And it's provided me a different way of being able to continue to sort of share people's stories and experiences, but also be able to immediately at least try to provide assistance. You know, the challenge that we have when we're out in the field as journalists is that you don't always see the impact. But when you're in the humanitarian space, there's a certain kind of magic when you're able to just bring a smile to a child's face. And I needed that.
Arwa Damon, we thank you so much for being with us. Stay safe. Award-winning journalist, was with CNN for 18 years, but now has founded Inara, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Speaking to us from Deir al-Balah in Gaza, outside Al-Aqsa Hospital. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. A federal jury in Virginia has ordered the U.S. military contractor CACI to pay $42 million to three Iraqi men who were tortured at the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. The landmark verdict came after 16 years of litigation, the first time a civilian contractor has been found legally responsible for the gruesome abuses at Abu Ghraib, which included murder, sexual assault, rape, the use of attack dogs, sleep deprivation, prolonged isolation, dietary manipulation, induced hypothermia, mock executions, and the humiliation of prisoners. We're joined right now by Bahar Azmi, legal director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, which represented the Abu Ghraib plaintiffs. In these last few minutes we have, Bahar, talk about what actually this lawsuit has been about and who wins this multimillion-dollar settlement.
Yeah, this lawsuit has been about justice and accountability for three Iraqi men, our clients, Salah, Suhail, and Assad, who exhibited, I think, just awe-inspiring courage and resilience to fight for 16 years and get over every innumerable hurdle khaki threw in its way to deflect responsibility, to have their voice heard by a jury. And as you said, it's also the first time a jury has ever had really the opportunity to review and judge U.S. practices, in this case, on by a private military contractor. In the 20 years since 9/11, and despite the horrific number of abuses inflicted on many, many dozens of other torture victims.
I mean, Blackwater is a military contractor, very well known. Explain what CACI, or now known as CACI, mm-hmm. did.
Yeah, so
when was
In 2003, CACI was hired by the United States government under a lucrative contractor to provide, quote, expert interrogators in Abu Ghraib, and they sent a number of highly unqualified individuals. The two qualified people who were there actually were whistleblowers and told CACI that they were seeing abuses there and needed to leave. And then, as it turned out, in the kind of command vacuum that persisted in Abu Ghraib, it was the CACI interrogators who took control and ordered military police, including military police who were court-martialed and spent time in prison for the very abuses CACI ordered them to undertake, to, quote, soften up detainees, set the conditions, particularly in the night shift. And all our clients suffered the kinds of abuses you regrettably showed on the screen.
So the photos of Abu Ghraib that shock the world, naked prisoners with bags over their heads, piled on top of each other in a human pyramid as an American soldier, Sabrina Harmon grins behind them. Her colleague, Charles Grainer, can be seen smiling, giving a thumbs up. Interestingly, Sabrina Harmon testified on behalf of the plaintiffs mm-hmm. and broke down on the stand.
Yeah, it was really remarkable and transformative testimony, because she's one of the co-conspirators who was taking direction from military intelligence, including CACI, to harm detainees. And she's somebody who expressed, like a lot of the MPs, just was broken by this experience. And what came out in the trial is military generals who investigated Abu Ghraib and documented sadistic, wanton, systemic abuses were outraged. The military police who were part of the CACI scheme were broken. And the only person who has never taken responsibility, CACI, until now.
I want to go to end with one of the plaintiffs, Salah al-Ajali, who was on Democracy Now! A decade ago. He talked about his time in solitary confinement at Abu Ghraib.
يعني قضايا التحقيق كانت التحقيق التي كانت تحدث كل يومين أو ثلاثة أيام يستمر التحقيق لساعة ساعة ونص.
These interrogations that happened every two or three days would last for an hour and a half or 2 hours in this manner. The details of the interrogations were different. In some cases they would bring dogs, then start the interrogation. In other cases they'd put you in a place and throw cold water or hot tea on you, then start the interrogation. But of course all the interrogations were conducted while you were kept naked and hooded, and they'd ask you questions to which you answer. I stayed for 40 days in a solitary cell, and 70% of that time I was kept naked.
That's Abu Ghraib prisoner Salah al-Ajali. He now lives in Sweden.
Mm-hmm. He now lives in Sweden, yeah. And just to clarify, the jury awarded each of the plaintiffs $3 million in compensatory damages and $33 million in punitive damages, because they saw right through CACI's deflection and finally held them responsible for the egregious and reckless conduct the jury found they engaged in. So it is a small victory in the context of broader human rights efforts in the global war on terrorism that so many people have been involved in over the 20 years, but it's still significant.
Bahar Azmi, thank you so much. I'm Amy Goodman. This is Democracy Now!
CFRC's funding drive is now underway. Join us at the Upper Hall of the Spire on Saturday, November 30th for Wrestling School of Rock in partnership with our friends at the Independent Wrestling Academy. The show is main evented by an Academy Championship match between Alexei Orlov and Geriatric. Also watch as Billy Baxter makes his professional wrestling debut against KL Shock. Proceeds from ticket sales support CFRC's funding drive. Get your tickets via CFRC.ca or IWAK.